Greetings and welcome to 10. We're discussing Paul Draper, professor of philosophy at Florida International University, and I'd like to refer to his article, Probabilistic Arguments from Evil, printed in 1993 in Religious Studies, a British journal. There, Draper says a very sensible and fine thing that we need to take into account when dealing with Roe, and Roe's argument behind the premise one of Roe's evidential argument. We're discussing, in effect, representative samples. When you have a whole of something, you can find out what that whole, for example, in opinion polls, you have a whole population, the United States, say, and you want to figure out what people are thinking with respect to, say, whether or not they agree with a certain decision or that a certain law should be passed. A polling sample. Well, it is, of course, expensive to make a sample of great size, just as it's expensive to get in contact with absolutely every human individual in America to make sure that they're voting a certain way, to find out how they're voting. And so what we do is we come up with a random sample. If a sample is truly random, as that sample grows bigger and bigger, we can hone in on and really have a good idea of what the larger population would in fact vote if the whole population voted. So samplings can be very important, but we have to make sure that our samplings are not biased. Now this is the thing at issue. Because if our sample of goods that we know of is biased, then this gives Roe no leg to stand on to say that, in fact, the goods we know of do not justify God, and therefore to conclude from that, that no goods at all would justify God in permitting Sue and the fawn to suffer. What Draper says is just straightforward and smart. He says this, in effect, when you have this huge population, let's say, of all the goods that there are, when we take a sampling of that, there has to be at least a chance that every possible good could have been in our sampling. But by the very nature of the game, goods beyond our ken, goods that are too complex for us to understand and appreciate and see at work in the world, those goods have no chance whatsoever of belonging to the goods, belonging to the sample of the goods that we know of. And so, therefore, we can conclude that the sample, in fact, is not random. Therefore, if the sample is not random, there's no other good reasons for thinking that this sample is representative. And so, we need to know that our sample is representative. But every good reason tells us that, given what Draper has said, that our sample, that is, the goods we know of, are not representative of all the goods that there are. Therefore, Roe's argument fails. The argument behind his premise one fails, that is, because he based the argument on this premise to this conclusion. One, no goods we know of justify God in allowing Sue or the fawn to suffer, therefore probably no goods at all justify God in allowing Sue or the fawn to suffer. We've shown now that Roe, at least given what he's said so far, is not within his rights to conclude that because the sample of goods we know of is not representative of all goods that there are. I'd like to turn now to discuss a response to Roe on this lecture by Stephen Weikstra, professor of philosophy at Calvin College. Weikstra has put together a very fine response to Roe, and we'll look at that as well as Roe's response to Weikstra on these lectures. If you have Weikstra to read, please read that at this time, and we'll return to discuss it. To sum up Weikstra's approach, we could say this. Roe has said that when he examines the fawn's suffering, that it appears to him that that suffering does not eventuate, does not gain some greater good. Okay? Weikstra's response is to say that Roe is not in his proper place, to say that evils appear in a certain way, that he is not allowed to say that with justification, because he, that is Roe, is leaving out an important part of theism. For theism holds, and this is what Weikstra is going to develop in his article, for theism holds that God is omniscient, which entails that God knows many more goods that are beyond our ken, beyond our abilities to understand. So it makes sense that in the hardest evils, in most difficult tragedies, it would be most difficult during those things for theists to come up with the right answer as to why God allows those things. But that's exactly what theism predicts. It predicts that in the really complex evils, we wouldn't understand those things, at least immediately. Weikstra has also pointed out a number of helpful things from and as response to Roe's article. I want to look at least one of these things that Weikstra has pointed out about Roe's article. One thing is this. Weikstra says that Roe's premise, too, was the claim that if God exists, he will not allow gratuitous evils to exist. And it's important to see what Roe takes premise 2 to mean, what Weikstra, in turn, takes premise 2 to mean. Weikstra takes premise 2, or as he calls it, P2, of Roe's argument, to mean this, that God's allowing the suffering, not the suffering itself, that's the thing that must serve some outweighing good. Okay, so when we say that in premise 2 of Roe's original argument, he was speaking of God is of such a being that he would not allow gratuitous evils, seemingly gratuitous evils, unless those evils brought about some greater good or avoided a worse, equal or worse evil. What Weikstra is saying is that it's God's permission of the gratuitous evil that must bring about the greater good, not necessarily the evil itself. Okay, you see the distinction. God may sometimes allow evils with the high probability that a certain good will, with a high probability, come about because, for example, a human being might make the right sort of response and grow as a result of that evil, facing some evil. However, unfortunately, people make the wrong sort of response to evil as well, and we're well prepared to accept that. We see it every day. As C.S. Lewis said in The Problem of Pain, sometimes pain leads people to, as he says, unrepentant rebellion. And so, at any rate, this is an important point by Weikstra. Sometimes God may allow an evil, but the resulting good that he had in mind by allowing the evil might not eventuate. In our own freedom, the good intended and foreseen by God may in fact be defeated by our not following through on our side and not making the right sort of response to evil. So, in effect, we have to read Roe's premise 2 as God's allowing the evil. That's the thing that must serve some outweighing good. This does not entail, as Weikstra says, that every instance of suffering necessarily makes the world a better place. As we've said, evil, suffering, is intrinsically evil. God might allow a certain instance of suffering, and there might be an outweighing good, namely God being able to use that evil as the best possible means to help a person to turn to a better life, to turn to the Lord, to choose the right path, to do the morally excellent thing. But there is the possibility, though God could foresee that those sorts of possibilities could come to pass, he has in his wisdom allowed moral failings as well. It seems that there has to be moral failings in the world in order that we might learn from them, in order that we might know that the evils we face are real evils, not just make-believe things, that we might know and trust that God is not necessarily going to step in and take up the slack every time there is a fearful or threatening situation on our hands. I think a thought experiment that has been designed by John Hick and developed by Clement Dorr, professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University, comes in really well here. The example paints the following picture. Imagine a world in which God desires, as I have stated as a major part of my theodicy, my theodical suggestions here, that soul maturation, the maturing of the spirit and moral character in a person, is why God allows a great amount of evil in this world. The skeptic is going to respond this: sure, God has to allow a good amount of evil in the world, but why does he allow really bad evils, evils that crush us, that go seemingly far beyond what we rationally are able to bear? Remember now, this is Hume's fourth circumstance, fourth criticism, and the one that Hick returns to towards the end of his book, Evil and the God of Love. This criticism remains, and Hick and Dorr try to deal with it using this following thought experience. Imagine a world in which God allows evils so people can mature. So, in a specific instance, say that Ralph is in pain. Insofar as Ralph understands the pain and wants to grow positively in his character by it, insofar as Ralph is able to bear that pain, God will allow it. But as soon as it gets to the level of being unbearable and seemingly soul-destroying rather than soul-making, wouldn't that be a better sort of world if God would eradicate that evil in that world? Insofar as Ralph can bear it, God allows it, but as soon as it becomes unbearable, God eradicates it. Wouldn't that be a better sort of world? Someone like Hume or Rowe might say. It's almost like matching together Hume's second and fourth criticisms. For Hume's second idea was that God could make the world such that there would be a number of divine volitions along the way. So in Ralph's case, God would take away the pain as soon as it got past the point in which it was beneficial for Ralph. Wouldn't that be a better sort of world? That's the thought experiment, but this is our reaction to it. This is how Dorr and Hick show that that world would not be better than our world. Okay, so the world we've envisioned about Ralph and his pain, if everyone's pain was like that in that world, this may well sound acceptable and quite reasonable, until you think about the overall ramifications of this thing being true, if it were true, in a world in which humans lived. Wouldn't it be the case that we would learn very quickly that if we bore pain to a certain amount, X, say, and then whenever we threw in the towel, as it were, and said, we just can't learn anything more from this pain, God would eradicate that pain? Wouldn't it be the case that very soon we would not respond to evil at all? For we would quickly learn that when we stopped responding to evil positively, God would intervene. We would be best just to leave it to him, because being all-powerful, he could just take care of all of our messes, and he would be so good at eradicating evil that we'd be best to allocate that job completely to him. Now, it seems to me clear, very clear, that there's major problems that would come about in such a world. For example, people in need along the roadside. In such a world as in Hick's and Dorr's thought experiment, God would help them, right? God would help the people on the side of the road. There would be no need to show them Christian love. God would help them and supply all their needs. Let God take care of it. If we don't respond, God will take care of it. Since God could do such a better job of eradicating intrinsic evils, we just wouldn't have to. And as you can see, in a world like that, in which God would allow pain just up to the threshold of someone growing from pain, but then would take away the pain immediately, in such a world, there would be no significant soul advancement. As soon as people learned that the best course of action would be not to respond at all to evil, God would take care of it, and we would learn nothing. We would merely ignore evil, and it would go away. But that's not the way, is it, brothers and sisters in Christ? It's not the way the world is. And it seems to me that this world, compared to Hicks and Dorr's world, this imagined world, that this world in which we live is morally and spiritually superior to the world of Dorr's and Hicks' thought experiment. Our world is superior to the world in which Ralph and his cohorts live. Now, Weikstra's attack on Roe is to go after him on the use of the word appear. If you look at Roe's article we referred to so far, in his discussion of the fawn, Roe appeals to the fawn's, quote, apparently pointless suffering. That is, it appears that the fawn's suffering is pointless. In a later portion of his article, he says, it certainly does not appear reasonable to believe this. That is, that the fawn's suffering was necessary to attain some greater good, or to avoid some evil just as bad or worse. Here's Weikstra's questions. Is it the case that we are always in our right, it is always right for us, or it is a right that we have, to say that something appears to be the case? What Weikstra tries to do is to come up with a formula that determines when we are in our rights to say that something appears a certain way to us, and when we are not within our rights to say the same thing. So it really does center on this idea and notion of to appear a certain way. Compare Weikstra's three cases that he comes up with in his article. His second example of using an appear claim is along these lines. Suppose that our spouse has asked us to look in the refrigerator and see if the milk there has gone sour. We go to the milk, unscrew the lid, and smell it, and not smelling the ordinary smell that accompanies sourness, we say, it does not appear to us that the milk is sour. Notice how we're using the word appear. We smell the milk, doesn't smell sour, and we say, it does not appear to us that the milk is sour. And yet, remembering that we have a head cold, and recalling that having a head cold takes away, often, our abilities to perceive smells such as sourness, we suddenly realize that we may not be within our rights to say this: the milk is sour, or even the milk is not sour. It could well be, Weikstra challenges us to think about, that we should simply suspend judgment on the milk's condition, because we just don't have the intellectual oomph, we don't have the cognitive powers at that time to determine one way or the other. In like manner, in the midst of intense suffering, it might appear that the suffering serves no, as Weikstra calls it, God-justifying purpose. That is, that it doesn't seem like there is a good reason for God to permit this suffering. We must ask in those instances whether we are in our rights to even form that judgment and to hold that judgment after we consider the sort of being that theism proposes for our belief. Let's consider Weikstra's cornea. Weikstra's article that we have been referring to so far occurred in 1984 in the journal, the International Journal for Philosophy of Religion. The name of his article is The Humean Obstacle to Evidential Arguments from Suffering on Avoiding the Evils of Appearance. And it's at the end of his section 3.1 that he first introduces this notion of cornea. He writes this. I should say first that cornea is basically a principle that, if correct, will help us to know when we're within our rights to make appear claims and when we are not within our rights to make appear claims. He writes this. And this is the substance of cornea. It goes like this. On the basis of cognized situation S, a human, H, is entitled to claim the following. It appears that P, only if now signals a necessary condition. When you're in situation S, H is entitled to claim the following. It appears that P, only if it is reasonable for that human being to believe that, given her cognitive faculties and the use she has made of them. If P were not the case, S would be different than it is in some way discernible by her. Okay, that's crinia. If P were not the case, S, the cognized situation, S would be different than it is in some way discernible by H. Weikstra is saying that as a general condition, as a necessary but not sufficient condition, that is, you have to meet this condition, it's necessary. Meeting doesn't certify that we are entitled to make the claim, but meeting this claim is necessary. So, it's necessary if right. So, if right, we have to meet cornea, that principle Weikstra suggests to us. We're in some situation S, a cognized situation. And H, this human, is entitled to make such and such claim only if, that is, that's a necessary condition, only if it is reasonable for that human to believe that, given the cognitive faculties and the present use that the person is able to make of them, if P were not the case, if P were not the case, S would be different than it is. The situation cognized would be different than it is in some way discernible by her. Remember now, we're trying to see when we are entitled to make the claim it appears that P. Okay, so consider his case of the sour milk again. If P were not the case, H would not have cognized S to be the case. Okay, so if that's the case, then, Weikstra claims, the person can make the appearance claim. Okay, now let's take the milk example again. Whether the milk is still sour, or whether it is still, whether the milk is sour, has become sour, or whether it is still good, in my present condition, namely having a head cold, I'm not able to tell one way or another. And so Weikstra's point is this. If I have a cold and I go to the refrigerator and open the milk jug and smell it, I'm not entitled to the claim. It appears the milk is not sour. The claim has no sort of usefulness to my hearers. Because of my head cold, I couldn't tell one way or another. So if I make the claim, it does not appear that the milk is sour. In effect, I haven't learned anything positive about my experience or from my experience. I'm reporting more on the inadequacies of my present conditions to tell one way or another than that I'm making some true objective statement about the true condition of the milk. Weikstra is, in effect, making use of a theorem that is very important in probability theory. It's called Bayes' theorem. Bayes' theorem was put together by the distinguished 18th century clergyman by the name of Thomas Bayes. No evidence is available to us as to whether Bayes' dabbling in probability made his clerical work any better or not, but at any rate, he gives us this probability theorem. The essence of the theorem, Bayes' theorem, without laying it out in all of its details, is this. So, BT, Bayes' theorem, the essence is this. If a hypothesis predicts that a certain phenomenon will be the case, if the hypothesis predicts that P will be the case, say, then if P comes about, P's occurrence cannot be used as evidence against that hypothesis. Okay, that's the heart of Bayes' theorem. In other words, if a hypothesis predicts that state C will come about, then if C does come about, you cannot use the fact that C has come about against that hypothesis, for C was the very thing that the hypothesis predicted would come about. How then does Bayes' theorem apply to theodicy? Well, starting in Weikstra's section entitled Cornea Applied, he says this. Roe, remember, had claimed that in a distant forest, this fawn had suffered, and it was apparently pointless. And from that, he makes the inductive argument that no goods we know about justify or would justify God in allowing the fawn to suffer. Therefore, probably, no goods in any sense whatever would justify God in allowing the fawn to suffer. From that, deductively, Roe concluded that there is no God, that God does not exist. What Weikstra makes clear in section 3.3 of his article is the fact that in comparison, our ability to understand and God's ability to understand the connections of good and evil in this world is in fact something perhaps like a one-month-old infant's wisdom compared to wise, intelligent parents' wisdom. He says, if you want to change the one-month figure, feel free, but make sure you change it so that whatever figure you suggest, it compares what you take to be your intellectual prowess, abilities, etc., when compared to omniscience. So, what we have in effect is a ratio. Our intelligence as humans in figuring out connections of good and evil is to omniscience as a small infant is to that of an adult wise human parent. It's important to keep in mind here that it's not necessarily the case that when the fawn suffers, that there has to be some good right then and there for the fawn, okay? That doesn't necessarily follow. It could be that sometime in the future there will be some good with respect to the fawn's suffering, and that's intimately connected to its suffering. I don't know how that would work exactly, but it could well be so. We know that parents that are not merely half-wits, as it were, but parents that are wise, intelligent, and provident for their children will inflict, I say inflict, perhaps a better word is to allow. Wise parents will in fact allow certain restrictions right now, will allow certain sufferings right now, so that later on a greater good will certainly or most likely occur from those current allowings. Isn't it the case that, as Weikstra says in a later article, if you have half-wit parents, who can barely put enough food on the table for the current day, it does not make sense to think that there is some future good that the parents have in mind by curtailing certain goods at the present time.